The Army Corps of Engineers opened another bay on the Morganza Spillway today. That move diverted still more water off the Mississippi through the bayous and rivers of the Atchafalaya Basin. The Corps says it will divert as much water as necessary to keep the Mississippi no higher than 45 feet as it passes through Baton Rouge. NPR's Greg Allen is in Baton Rouge, and he reports that some of that water may actually be welcome.
Few people pay closer attention to water conditions in the Atchafalaya Basin than those who make their living catching crawfish.
The ramp is further out over there. It's about even with these trees over here. You just can't get to it.
Lee Wisdom and other crawfishermen here in St. Martin Parish are launching their boats not off the ramps, but from the levee. Water has already risen several feet here on Bayou Benoit, and water from the Morganza Spillway hasn't even reached this area yet. Mike Bienvenu is head of the Louisiana Crawfish Producers Association. He's not sure whether the coming flood will improve the crawfish crop or not.
Because we don't like high water. Well, high water is not good. We want good water. You know, all we need is 3 or 4 feet of crawfish water to fish crawfish. That's all we need.
Crawfishing has declined here in recent years. Bienvenu and others blame the web of canals and levees that oil and gas companies have put in the Atchafalaya Basin, keeping fresh water from some bayous. When the high water hits this area in coming weeks, it will flush out stagnant ponds with fresh water, full of oxygen and sediment. Harold Scheffler, who's fished these waters his whole life, says that's bound to improve things in the basin. As water washes up on levees and other formerly dry areas, he says long-dormant crawfish will come out of the mud and start breeding.
So you get this phenomenal production. And then shrimp. This is an estuary where shrimp from the Gulf come into this system and reproduce. So you have this phenomenal amount of nutrients in water that's going to cause an enormous growth of shrimp, which feeds speckled trout and redfish and flounder, and the whole thing just takes off.
Short term, the high water is threatening a huge animal population, including as many as 150 black bears, plus many deer and smaller mammals. Scheffler, who's longtime chair of the Sierra Club in this part of Louisiana, says for the most part, the animals should do fine. Water is rising slowly, and he says even at the crest, there will be plenty of high ground in the basin.
We have spore banks up there 50, 55 feet above sea level. Many hills in the 35 to 45 foot range. But really islands for wildlife.
It might be surprising that although 1.5 million cubic feet of water per second may soon be released into this basin, those living here are remarkably undisturbed. That's in part because flooding is a natural part of this area's ecology. This flood event, the largest since 1973, will reshape the basin, filling in some swamps with sediment and turning them into hardwood forests. For Louisiana's long eroding coastal wetlands, though, this flooding is a good thing. Ivor Van Heerden, a marine scientist formerly with Louisiana State University, says the tons of sediment washing down the river will spur plant and animal life and help build new wetlands.
In the central part of the coast, because of the Atchafalaya, we're going to definitely be creating new marshes. We're going to be rejuvenating a huge area of marsh, so a lot of benefits.
Paul Kemp of the National Audubon Society agrees. Unfortunately, he says, the place where new sediment and new marshes are needed most desperately, below New Orleans, won't be helped by the flood. Because of efforts to keep the Mississippi wide open for navigation, any sediment flowing down the river is likely to be dredged and dumped, not in coastal areas, but off the continental shelf.
I would have loved to say this was the event we were waiting for. We were prepared, and we were able to do 50 years of restoration in 1 year. I can't say that today.
Kemp, Van Heerden, and others active in coastal restoration hope this event will convince the Army Corps of Engineers and other public agencies to take steps allowing not just the Atchafalaya, but also the Mississippi to actually benefit from the flood. Greg Allen, NPR News, Baton Rouge.
A top executive in professional basketball has come out and said he is gay. Commentator Frank DeFord sees that acknowledgement by the Phoenix Suns executive Rick Welts as a positive step, though Frank wonders when a professional team athlete will do the same.
Suddenly, with a diverse sampler of incidents, the subject of homosexuality in sport has again moved back to the forefront. Invariably, too, this brings up the question, when will the first gay male American athlete in a prominent professional team sport step forward and declare his sexuality? True or not, male athletes have been generally assumed to be uneasy about gays in their midst, if not downright homophobic. Certainly, the slur that Kobe Bryant called out to an NBA referee, which cost him a $100,000 fine, has been common in locker rooms for years, as it has been in many places of business. But then athletes are not apart from society, and they are young, and since so many surveys indicate that younger Americans are more accepting of gays and lesbians, it is most likely that the antipathy toward possible gay teammates has greatly diminished. The public anti-gay tirade that the Atlanta Braves pitching coach, Roger McDowell, went on recently before a game in San Francisco, which cost him a 2-week suspension, was certainly extreme. Quite possibly, though, McDowell, who is 50, is more a representative of some of his generation than he is of much of his profession. Still, sports certainly does do some tiptoeing around the general subject of homosexuality. Sean Avery, a hockey player, was criticized for making a commercial in support of same-sex marriage, while Peter Vidmar, a gold medal gymnast, felt obliged to resign a very prominent position with the American team in next year's Olympics because he was criticized for speaking out against same-sex marriage. What is this? To serve our Olympic team, you can't have any personal opinions about divisive issues? Aha. But in domestic sports, on the team, what do you think? If a prominent American player did come out and you were in a stadium or arena when he played against your home team, and a fan near you holding yet another beer on high began screaming, "Hey, you dirty blankety blank," what do you think would happen? Do you think the other fans would laugh and hoot too? Maybe even a chant would start, "Frankie is a blank blank, Frankie is a blank blank." Or would the fans around the guy screaming anti-gay rants tell him to shut up? Might someone actually confront him personally? Might, in counterpoint, some fans even start to cheer the visiting gay athlete? If you think the latter, if more tolerance toward gays has come to the arena, as it has in so much else of American life, then perhaps very soon a closeted gay male team athlete will dare come out. In the meantime, vis-a-vis tolerance, let us encourage the U.S. Olympic Committee to plead with Peter Vidmar to rejoin the American team, an honorable gentleman whom we all can respect, whether or not we can agree with one opinion of his.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. So for tech-savvy individuals like Sarah Marzinski, online tools can make budgeting much easier. Mint.com is only one of several web-based personal financial management sites. There's also Thrive, Money Strands, and Buxfirm. Joan Goldwasser is a senior reporter for Kiplinger's Personal Finance. She explains some of the benefits of using these programs.
You're seeing sort of a complete financial picture, how much money you have, whether it's your paycheck coming in because it's getting deposited into your bank account, the money that's going out because the checks that you write are shown there, plus your credit card bill shows up, and you also can have, you know, a brokerage statement, so your long-term investments show up. So you can get sort of a total financial picture of how much money you have, how much you're spending, and where you're spending it.
Do you have any tips for how one would take best advantage of what the features that most of these programs have?
Well, I mean, the main thing you want to do is pay attention to it. You know, if you're trying to save for a goal and they will help you do this, you know, look at where you are. You know, I want to buy a house in 5 years. So you can, you know, put down, you know, how much you think you're going to spend on this house, and it will help you figure out what percentage down payment is reasonable, and then how much you need to save each month so that in 5 years you will have the money for your down payment for your house, or you want to save for retirement. And it will help you figure out whether you're actually on track for meeting, you know, these goals.
And those are somewhat long-term goals. But for a very, what would be an example of a short-term goal?
Oh, you know, I'm going on vacation in 6 months. I want to make sure that I have enough cash so that I can, you know, to spend when I take my vacation. I
don't want to. As opposed to putting it all on the credit card and
right,
not thinking
exactly.
About
say,
it.
Okay, you know, I want to have this money set aside so that I can go out to eat and do whatever I want to do and not have an enormous credit card bill when I return.
Now, since one needs to put so much your financial information onto these sites. What are the risks?
Well, they say that they have bank-level security and that everything is encrypted. Most of the sites don't actually store your information. They do what the technical term is screen scraping. So they go to the bank's website and sort of pull the information in. But you obviously have to be comfortable with having information online.
All in all, what's the profile of people who are really best suited to use these sites to really help them out and to keep at it?
Well, I think anybody who does online banking probably would find it pretty seamless to, you know, move over into one of these sites and to get a better picture. Obviously, it takes a little bit of motivation to go in every day or every week and check. But if you do, it does remind you of where you stand financially.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Happy to be with you.
Joan Goldwasser is a senior reporter for Kiplinger's Personal Finance.
And now we want to tell you about a competition where those involved say the point is not the point, it's the poetry. It's billed as the largest youth poetry slam in the world. It's held in Chicago, and it's called Louder Than a Bomb. And now there's a new documentary about it that is getting big buzz and winning awards even before its official debut. Here's a clip.
So excuse the couple of cockiness I ever show when rocking this, just trying to give my everything for everything I got from this. Kevin Koval told me I could write. My slam coach told me not to hype. I've loved and lost on final stages. The fates told me it's not the night. But still, I thank this forum for help making me so strong, for letting me talk about sex, drugs, basketball, and moms. Fond farewell to this chapter and to all the joy and laughter. This for every kid whose voice has been louder than a bomb.
That was 2008 slam poetry competitor Nate Marshall, and it comes from the new documentary Louder Than a Bomb. Its nationwide theatrical rollout begins today at the IFC Center in New York. It's scheduled to appear on the Oprah Winfrey Network OWN later this year. Here to tell us more about it is the film's co-director, Greg Jacobs. He's with us from NPR member station WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did you get on to this?
I just happened to be driving by near Wrigley Field in Chicago with my wife, and there's a famous rock club nearby called the Metro. And that night, on the marquee, there was a sign that said, Louder Than a Bomb High School Poetry Slam Finals Tonight, and a line of kids of all shapes and sizes and colors all down the block. Chicago is such a segregated city that it was unusual to see that kind of diversity among youth. And to see it on a Saturday night for kids who were there to see poetry was not something that I remembered doing for fun when I was in high school. And that also meant that there were kids who were on stage who were reading and performing their poems for other kids. That struck me as amazingly brave and unusual. I went back on Monday and talked to my co-director, John Siskel, about how interesting this seemed. And he said, well, let's take a look.
The title of the film comes from the title of the competition itself. Where does that come from?
The idea came shortly after 9/11, actually. The coincidence of 9/11, and at the time in Chicago, there was talk about anti-gang loitering laws that would essentially make it a crime for kids to gather in small groups. And there were a bunch of poets and teachers who were working with these kids in the schools and knew how creative they were, but wanted to provide a safe space for them where they could do the kind of creativity they were seeing without having to worry about the kind of pressures that were then going on in the world. So they decided to create this space by setting up a citywide poetry slam, and they kind of cribbed the title from a Public Enemy song, Louder Than a Bomb, because the notion was these kids' words are more powerful than any weapon.
The film follows three individuals from separate teams and then a team as a whole. And one of the things that I think is interesting is that the film makes the point that this isn't just something that poor kids do when they have nothing else to do, that there are kids from all different backgrounds who are attracted to this, and that's my way of leading with Adam. Here it is.
Poetry now, because once you start your piece, you can die behind that microphone, and death may be breathless, but poetry's deathless, so breath be our savior eternal. Poets, breathe once with me now. That's one poem we all wrote.
So tell me a little bit about Adam Gottlieb. He's from Northside College Prep. Why was he attracted to poetry in general, the Poetry Slam experience, until Louder Than a Bomb?
I always describe Adam as the most exotic character you will see in any documentary because he is perfectly well-adjusted. He is an incredibly sweet hippie kid from a very comfortable middle-class family. And when you see him in this context at Louder Than a Bomb or at the Slam, you kind of think he's going to get beaten up and get his lunch money stolen. But then he gets on stage and he is this absolutely astonishing performer. He sort of represents the incredible community that gets created at this event, where kids from all sides of the city who may never, ever come in contact with each other get to meet and hear each other's stories and learn to respect each other.
And then there's Nova. Nova's kind of a tough cookie. And just give you a little sense of that. Well, instead of playing Nova, we'll play a little bit from her coach when he first met her and how he describes Nova.
I told her, Nova, you did a great job, but you're a freshman and there are a lot of upperclassmen with more experience who are going to make the team ahead of you. She gave me this mean, dirty look. She stormed out the room and I heard her say something like, I didn't make the team because I'm a freshman, what kind of bull is that? And fortunately, she didn't just throw in the towel at that point. But it was clear no one was going to mess with this kid.
And how did she get drawn to this poetry slam? And tell us a little bit more about her life, if you would, about why, in part, why she's so tough.
Yeah, she's a beautiful young woman, half Indian, half African American, with a 1,000-watt smile, but she is absolute steel. She grew up in a family of, I think, 4 kids, and her youngest brother, Cody, has something called Fragile X syndrome and a whole other host of problems. Her parents got divorced, and that left her mom to work 3 jobs and essentially left Nova to take care of Cody. So while everybody else was out having fun and partying and whatever, Nova was always the incredibly responsible one. By the time she got into high school, she had a lot of anger because of that. So her coach convinced her to sign up for the slam team, and she did. And having this outlet really seemed to make everything better.
Tell us a little bit about, more about Nate Marshall, whom we met in the beginning of the introduction. We played a short clip from him. Tell me about why you picked him.
His parents, when he was very, very little, were both drug addicts. They soon afterwards cleaned up. And ultimately, the home Nate came from was a very loving kind of working class house, with his mom in particular as this incredibly strong central figure. And he was identified early on as gifted. He is an extraordinarily talented writer as well as an extraordinarily talented rapper. One of my favorite moments in the film at the very end, when we're asking the kids what they plan on doing, he says he's going to go to grad school, become a professor and or rap star.
Well, of course.
Yeah, maybe both.
What else would you do exactly? If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Greg Jacobs, co-director of Louder Than a Bomb. It's a new documentary about the world's largest youth poetry slam held in Chicago. The poetry slam is by the same name, and the film begins its national theatrical rollout tonight in New York. Greg, we've been talking about some of the characters in the film, but I do have to mention that this film has been very well received even before it's been viewed nationally. I'm wondering what you think people are responding to. I don't think you'll mind my mentioning it's won 11 Festival Awards before it's even been widely seen. So what do you think people respond to?
I think people see hope in these kids. They see profound love in the teachers and the parents and the community around them. And the hope is that they leave the theater feeling that the world's a better place than when they walked in.
I wanted to ask about that, too, because one of the things that the film follows is the team from Steinmetz Academic Center, which is they describe it as not being one of the places that people think excellence comes from. And we are living in a time when there's a lot of talk about American education and teachers are up to snuff, whether the kids are learning enough. There are some people who have the impression that just kids are going to hell in a handbasket. Is part of the message of this film, no, they're not? Or is part of the message of the film that any kid can be great if they find something that they love?
That second way is a very good way to put it. The Steinmetz kids got started, and a lot of the themes of their work involve how much talent there is at Steinmetz that doesn't really have an outlet. The expectations are so low and the assumptions about these kids are so low that nothing ever happens with it. So I think the Steinmetz kids are such an inspiration because they are sort of what happens if you're banging your head against the ceiling and then all of a sudden there's a space and you get to fly out of it.
And has it whetted your desire to write a few poems yourself?
I am not going to be writing any poetry because seeing how good these kids are make me say I'm just happy to be on the other side of the camera.
All right. Greg Jacobs is the co-director of Louder Than a Bomb. It's a documentary about the world's largest high school performance poetry competition by the same name. Its national theatrical release starts today. And Greg Jacobs was with us from Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you'd like to find out how you can see the film, we'll link to its website on our website. Go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More.